Syrian President Bashar al-Assad takes the oath of office following his re-election in the country's presidential vote in May. At least 160 people are confirmed dead in flooding in Germany and Belgium. Numbers are expected to rise as hundreds are still missing. And Russia reports over 25,000 new daily COVID-19 cases and 787 deaths. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Syria, where President Bashar al-Assad has been sworn in for another seven-year term after winning the May election. Assad took the oath of office for the fourth time during an official ceremony at the presidential palace in Damascus. In an address, Assad hailed the Syrian people for their resistance against the enemy's plots. He said Syria would not be divided, added that all bets against his country have failed. The Syrian president also appreciated Iran and Russia's support for freeing his country from terrorists. He called it his priority to free other parts of Syria that are still in the hands of the terrorists, backed by Turkey and the United States. Assad won the presidential election by a landslide, securing more than 95% of the votes. This was his second victory since the foreign-backed insurgency engulfed the Arab country in 2011. Well, regarding Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and being sworn in for the fourth time a little while ago, we were joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who updated us about the official ceremony.
He also highlighted the importance of the next period in the economic sector in Syria. He said that work will be focused on renewable energy and investment in the country. As you know, we are in a very difficult situation, the Syria economic situation, in light of the destruction that happened by foreign-backed terrorism, also in light of the economic sanctions by the United States and the West, those sanctions that have made the Syrians' daily lives much more difficult and made it almost impossible for the Syrian government to import the basic needs for the Syrians every day. So definitely the most important priority for the Syrians and for the Syrian president and for the government currently will be the economic situation. He was focusing on the agricultural sector, on the industrial sector, on reopening all of the factories that were affected by the war in various parts of the country. So all the focus will be now on inside Syria, not on the outside like before the war. The agricultural sector, the investment sector, he will also be giving investments, definitely will be giving investments for its allies that sit with it, for example, Iran, Russia, and China.
Representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban have launched fresh peace talks in the Qatari capital of Doha. Several high-ranking officials, including former President Hamid Karzai and the head of the High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, are attending the negotiations. Now, the spokesman for the government's negotiating team said Kabul expects negotiators to make headway with the talks in a short time and to reach a result. He expressed hope that the talks will lead to a lasting peace in the country. Negotiations come as Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages and have captured a vast swath of territory. Now, the Afghan military has been engaged in fierce fighting with the militants in some areas to try to retake the control of those regions, including a southern border crossing with Pakistan. Let's cross over to Kabul, joined by Amin Alami. Amin, good to have you with us. Well, fill us in on this latest round of talks and expectations.
Well, Marzia, the Afghan government officials and the Taliban side finally resumed the long-delayed intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. As you mentioned, a group of high-ranking Afghan officials, including former top politicians, for instance, former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, as well as some of jihadi leaders and well-known politicians, have gone to the Qatari capital, Doha, and resumed the intra-Afghan negotiations with the Taliban side. Both sides, I mean the Taliban and the Afghan government, are optimistic about the results of this round of intra-Afghan negotiations in the Qatari capital, Doha. For instance, Ghulam Farooq Majroor, who is one of the members of the negotiator team of the Afghan government and is currently in the Qatari capital, Doha, said that we are optimistic about the results of the negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban militant in the Qatari capital, Doha. In the meantime, Dr. Mohammed Naeem Mubarak, who is also a person of reach an agreement, and it's expected that we will reach an agreement with the Afghan government's side, he also has expressed that at this time, both negotiating teams need to think about the fate of their own country and think about this fact that this is only Afghan people who are authorized to decide about the fate of their own country and about the fate of the nation. In the meantime, the negotiations resumed in the Qatari capital, Doha, while Afghan security forces and Taliban are fighting against each other across the country, mainly in northern, southern, and western parts of Afghanistan. But as a fresh development, according to Afghanistan's defense ministry, Afghan security forces retake the control of two key districts in central Bamiyan province of Afghanistan, Kohmat and Saigon, as well as Sheikh Ali district is also liberated as a result of Afghan army ground operations in Parwan province. But the security situation in most of other provinces are going to be not good. And that is why the Afghan civilians, mainly the local people here in Afghanistan, say that they are worried about the results of even this negotiation between Afghan government and the Taliban in Doha. For instance, residents of Ghazni province and even the city of Ghazni say that the Taliban has reached to the entrance gates of this strategic city that is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway. They also say that some parts of this key city in southern Afghanistan is currently under the control of Taliban. For instance, the police district 7th and police district 5th inside Ghazni city, according to locals, are currently under the control of the Taliban militants. But Afghan security sources, mainly Afghanistan's defense ministry, just recently declared that a large number of commander troops have been deployed to Ghazni province to retake back the control of the lost areas, mainly the suburbs of Ghazni, from the Taliban militants.
All right, thank you so much for that update. Out of Kabul, that's Ami Alami. Turning to Europe now, where devastating floods have taken place in the western part of that continent, which have claimed at least 160 lives. That number could rise as rescuers are still searching for hundreds who are missing. Germany is the worst-hit country, where police say 133 people have died as a result of the disaster. A dam at risk of collapsing in North Rhine-Westphalia has forced the evacuation of thousands of people. Meanwhile, in Belgium, at least 27 deaths have been confirmed, and the interior minister says another 20 people are missing. The deluge has also submerged homes in Luxembourg and the Netherlands. The cost of damage in Europe's worst floods in decades is estimated at several billion euros. Now efforts are being made to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. Well, the European High Court of Justice has ruled in favor of European businesses who want to sack employees for wearing religious clothing in front of customers, although the court did say that the ban was meant to be implemented fairly and neutrally. Many predict that it will unfairly be used to target Muslim women, many of whom wear the hijab or niqab. Robert Carter reports from London.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means, or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
A COVID-19 cases surge in several EU nations, mainly attributed to the highly contagious Delta variant. The development could have major health and economic implications. Jerome Hughes brings us more.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontents to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive.
Be vaccinated or not, so you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, British Health Secretary Sajid Javid says he has tested positive for COVID-19 as the country faces a fresh surge of infections.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to update you all that I've tested positive for COVID. I was feeling a bit groggy last night, so I took a lateral flow test this morning and it's come out positive. So I'm now self-isolating at home with my family until I get the results of a PCR test.
In the video posted on Twitter, the 51-year-old said he was fully vaccinated and his symptoms were very mild. Javid has been health secretary for only 3 weeks. He was named to the post after Matt Hancock resigned for breaching social distancing guidelines. Javid has supported Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to lift all lockdown restrictions in England on Monday. Scientists have warned that the move is a threat to the world and provides fertile ground for the emergence of vaccine-resistant variants. On Friday, Britain recorded more than 50,000 daily cases for the first time since mid-January. The country has the seventh highest COVID-19 death toll in the world. It has fully vaccinated two-thirds of its adult population. Meantime, Russia has reported over 25,000 coronavirus infections, taking the overall caseload to nearly 6 million. Authorities also said nearly 790 people died from the disease in 24 hours. That pushes the overall COVID-related death toll to more than 147,000. The country reported nearly 800 deaths on Friday, the highest in a single day since the pandemic broke out there. Russia has been in the grip of a surge in cases, with authorities blaming the Delta variant and people's reluctance to get vaccinated. The capital, Moscow, and the second largest city, St. Petersburg, remain the epicenters of the recent outbreak. Russia is the worst hit country in Europe by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. Thailand has registered new records in the number of daily coronavirus infections and deaths there. The country confirmed over 10,000 new cases and 141 more deaths on Saturday. Thailand has imposed a nationwide ban on public gatherings and is considering more restrictions on movement. Violations can carry a maximum penalty of 2 years in jail, $1,200 fines, or both. The Southeast Asian country's worst coronavirus outbreak so far is fueled by the highly transmissible Alpha and Delta COVID variants. Since the pandemic started, Thailand has confirmed nearly 392,000 cases and over 3,200 fatalities. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by the U.S. state's algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Scott Temke, author. This article is published under the heading West Africa, its latest testing ground for U.S. military artificial intelligence. Stay tuned for more. One striking feature of U.S. military involvement in West Africa is the absence of an observable strategic vision for a desired end state. Nominally, U.S. presence in the region's multi-layered conflicts revolves around building security cooperation with state partners to improve counterterrorism capabilities, ostensibly providing protection to communities that states cannot. Concurrently, the U.S. military is typically the prime diplomatic entity for high-level bilateral engagements. The result is that the U.S. military is propping up the public authority of weak states, albeit in an ad hoc fashion that lurches from crisis to crisis. Regardless of the reasons for U.S. presence, there is hardly any deep public support for these operations. About 60% of U.S. citizens do not view these kinds of conflicts as a security threat, and more than 90% oppose U.S. invasions, even if weapons of mass destruction were in use. For the first time in recent memory, U.S. international relations scholar John Mearsheimer and Stephen Vogt write, large numbers of Americans are openly questioning their country's grand strategy. Even within the Department of Defense, these doubts continue to periodically arise. As former Defense Secretary Mark Esper testified in February 2020 to the House Armed Services Committee, conventional forces in Niger, Chad, and Mali need to go back to home so they can prepare for great power competition. Due to war fatigue, the U.S. has resorted to externalizing the strategic and operational burden of war to human and technological surrogates, creating what some scholars call a form of surrogate warfare. One example of externalizing the burden of the war to the machine is a tool created by Defense Innovation Unit and deployed at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar in 2017. Throughout its deployments, this tool monitored and rapidly combined social media feeds in Syria before relaying that information to pilots and ground troops, who then used it to identify, track, and strike targets in that area of operations. General Joseph Votel, then commander of U.S. Central Command, boasted of the model's success and indicated that it would be replicated in future operations. In its preparation for great power competition, the U.S. military is modernizing its joint airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, that is ISR, capabilities by exploring the uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques for target identification. The final goal is to connect ISR sensors across all warfighting domains, including space, air, land, sea, and cyber, directly with commanders and weapon systems, sharing data at an accelerated speed. In Niger, this project has materialized as the deployment of the new Block 5 variant of MQ-9 Reaper, a drone first used in Syria in 2017. The Block's fifth major upgrades include the ability to integrate and combine multiple data feeds, as well as to process this data more quickly. Since 2018, the U.S. has similarly armed their drones in Niger. In this fashion, West Africa joins Syria as a place that has become a testbed for this new wave of ISR technologies. The ISR modernization program follows prior U.S. military investment in the region with projects like the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, a military aid package of $353 million. These military initiatives contribute to the African continent's status as a long-standing field site for experimentation that traverses the colonial and post-colonial eras. More recently, since the publication of the Berg Report, Africa has been a proving ground for the neoliberal thought that permeates development economics, advocating for structural adjustment policies, while most foreign direct investment is concentrated in resource extraction economies. This thinking tended to stop well short of acknowledging the enduring damage done by colonialism on the continent. Niger's colonial experience was particularly vicious, with French military violence used to pacify the territory. This trend continued in the lead-up to Niger's 1960 independence. As French military forces suppressed opposition so the French state could consolidate control over uranium deposits discovered between 1957 and 1967 and other minerals useful for high-technology industries. Today, uranium from French mines accounts for about 70% of Niger's exports, but tax exemptions mean that little of that value flows to state or its citizens. It is against this background that Niger provides a good case study of intersection between the rural poor's land struggles and U.S. military presence. Most Nigerians are subsistence farmers whose land tenure rights are insecure. The country is susceptible to frequent drought and severe food shortages, conditions which have been exacerbated by climate change. As of 2004, 9% of Nigerians, about 870,000 people, were enslaved or lived as bonded laborers. One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by U.S. state algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Arguably, because of a strategic non-oversight, West Africa is conducive for testing these weapon systems and assessing how they form a kind of predatory formation that spans from the borders to the hinterlands of the world.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Imam al-Baqir salamullahi alayhi, besides the specific words of the Prophet that he presented to the Ummah of the Prophet, besides the particular sunan, traditions of the Prophet that he tried to shed light on, the ahkam of Islam that he tried to shed light on, the tafsir of Quran that he tried to shed light on, besides the specifics, there were certain components that he stressed on repeatedly and created this, I want to call it a culture because it became widespread. Be it that not exactly every aspect or every detail of the approach that he's presenting for people to have was taken on board by everyone, but a movement was created that led the Muslim community overall to leave the conditions they were in towards better conditions. And those principles are this. Look at the Quran itself. Refer to the Quran. We have companions coming to the Imam, asking him about ahkam. The Imam could respond with the... Again, this is this example. I hope I'm able to deliver it properly, where we get the point from it. The Shia, okay, not the non-Shia who don't see the Imam as muftarad al-ta'a and the one who has the knowledge of Islam, the knowledge of the Quran, the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet. That is a different topic. It's related, it's very much connected, but I insist on understanding this so that we don't dismiss it as this is for others. No, this is for us. Companions of the Imam would come and ask questions about the ahkam. The Imam could simply just say, this is what the hukm is. The Imam doesn't do that. He said, have you read this verse of the Quran? Or in some instances, this could be understood from this verse of the Quran, that verse of the Quran. Telling people, go back to the Quran itself. What happened to that? Instead of going and saying, oh, hadith says, مِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ Hadith says this is Ibn Muljam. Like, okay, hadith says it's Ibn Muljam. It must be Ibn Muljam. We're confused here. مَنْ يَقُول مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَهُوَ أَلَدُّ الْخِصَامِ This is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Hadith says it's Ali ibn Abi Talib. We get, Imam says, look at the verse of the Quran. Look at the Quran itself. The Quran says, مِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ There are those who give up their souls for مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ Then go and look at what's available. It's not too difficult to find out who Ibn Muljam is and too difficult to find out who Ali ibn Abi Talib, his track record. Now you see, is this مِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ or that? They can fabricate hadith. The Imams kept repeating, go to the Quran, read the Quran. Look at the Quran. The approach to go to the Quran, get an understanding, judge hadith based on what Quran says. This is one of the those lines that is repeatedly mentioned by the Imam. It's not a specific, you know, do this or do that, this hukm or that verse of the Quran, the tafsir of it, this story in the Quran, that story at the time of the Prophet or previous revelations. All those are important. But these are guidelines that straighten out your thinking process. It helps you be able to clear up not one issue, 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000 issues. These are keys to knowledge. Go to the Quran. Read the Quran. This is one of the major teachings of Imam Zain al-Abidin. The second very important thing that the Imam repeats, and we see the effect of it. Again, I will like to present this very briefly. Look, the compilers of hadith that started putting books together, they all fall a little after, they start doing this work a little after roughly the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin. The process starts at that point. There is close to a century before that time. Why did that not happen? Why did that not happen? Because the work of the Ahlul Bayt wasn't on this area. They were trying to, again, when we discussed Imam al-Mujtaba and Imam Al-Hussein, with their objective, how they were trying to bring the Ummah back onto its track was different. That didn't work. They started working in this way. Imam Zain al-Abidin onwards started working on this. These teachings of Imam al-Baqir are what led to the Muslim community developing this form of scholarship that you have the likes of Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim and the other Sahih Sittah. They went towards filtering out the hadith based on what principle? Based on what? Check the narrators of hadith. Who who's narrating this hadith? What's the chain of transmission? This is the work of Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhi that has led to this. Somebody tells you Amir al-Mu'mineen said this. Okay, I didn't live Amir al-Mu'mineen. Anything he says is on my head. I will kiss it and I will accept it no matter what it is, if he has said it. But has he said it or not? Someone claiming Ali ibn Abi Talib said it doesn't mean that he said it. Someone claiming the Prophet said it doesn't mean he said it. Someone claiming Imam al-Hussein said something doesn't mean he said it. Based on what? What's the evidence of him saying it? What book was this taken off of? Imam al-Baqir stressed on this. And it affected the entirety of the Muslim community. Those books started coming out. The works of the companions of the Ahlul Bayt became even more strict. They were even more careful. And that's why we say the majority of the ahadith that we have compiled in our books, compilations of hadith, is much more accurate. Still, does that mean there is nothing that is off? If it's in our books, that means it's accepted? No, again. There is no saying from any of the imams suggesting this book or that book, whatever is in it is accepted. We have said, if this book says it, we have said it. There's no such thing whatsoever. The imams stressed on this for that time onwards, so all the way until the end of the minor occultation, when Khulaini puts his book together, he is relying on a volume of resources, books of various scholars. Does he just take that book and narrate whatever's in it? Absolutely not. But this is the book of Hariz ibn Abdullah al-Sajistani, the student of Zurara ibn A'yan. Doesn't matter, that's what the book says, but there's this copy, there's the other copy, this one comes from this person, that comes from that person. The reason why the hadith book of Al-Kafi took 20 years to compile is not because the resources weren't there. It's because Khulaini is very careful. Where did this come from? Where did that come from? Now, if Khulaini did that, does that mean whatever he says? No, that doesn't mean if his judgment is that it's the saying of the imam. Although this filters out a lot of stuff, it still doesn't mean it's necessary. There's still the process of ijtihad in looking at this. This is the teaching of Imam al-Baqir.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across the United States western region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them more difficult. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled Western US and Canada Brace for Another Heat Wave as Wildfires Spread. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Fourth searing heat wave in 5 weeks is set to strike western United States and Canada in the coming days, aggravating wildfires that are already ravaging an area larger than Rhode Island, as drought and record-breaking temperatures tied to the climate crisis pummel the region. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, the impending heat wave comes as 12 states are already battling 71 active wildfires. The combined area of the blazes is about 1,553 square miles, that is 4,021 square kilometers. The largest blaze by far continues to be the Bootleg Fire in south-central Oregon, which has been burning for 9 days now and has devastated an area larger than New York City, with no sign of letting up. As of Thursday morning, 15th of July, the fire was at only 7% containment, and the cause remained unknown. Almost 2,000 houses are currently threatened by the Bootleg wildfire. Tim McCarley described to the Associated Press having to flee his home in a rural area north of Bly. He said, "The sheriff's department had been there, and they said, if you don't get out of here right now, then you're going to die." He added, "We were running around like a chicken with a head cut off, throwing stuff into the car. Then we say, okay, that's it, we've got to go." They evacuated from the flames, which came within just 5 feet or 1.5 meters of their house. Several large wildfires are also burning across Northern California, including the Dixie Fire, which erupted on Wednesday, 14th of July, and has grown to more than 2,250 acres, close to where the deadly 2018 campfire tore through the town of Paradise, remains at 0% containment. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, "It's a lot of steep and inaccessible terrain, and that's making it really difficult to get containment." She added, "Ground crews have to hike in, so it is a lot of work for the firefighters." In the early hours of Wednesday, 14th of July, the fire raced along the steep terrain about 10 miles or 16 kilometers from the town of Paradise in Northern California. The current fire, which erupted in the rugged Feather River Valley northeast of the town of Paradise, has not advanced towards it, and residents have not been ordered to evacuate their homes. Larry Peterson, whose home in neighboring Magalia survived the previous blaze, said some of his neighbors were getting their belongings together in case they had to flee the region. He told KHSL-TV, "Anytime you've got a fire after what we went through and another one is coming up, you've got to be concerned." Other local residents stocked up on water and other items. Jennifer Uni of the town of Paradise said, "We pretty much left with our clothes on our backs during the previous wildfire." She added, "So this time we're looking to be more prepared and more vigilant." Joyce McLean's home burnt last time, but she rebuilt it and would again rebuild if necessary. McLean said, "We just take each day as it comes and if it happens." She added, "There's not much that we can do about it." Bill Connolly told the Sacramento Bee Daily, "Because little of the foliage has grown back in the area since the 2018 Paradise Blaze, there is nothing there now for the current wildfire to burn," the Butt County supervisor. While in Mariposa County in California, the river fire was brought to 36% containment after destroying 5 structures and burning through 9,500 acres of land. Evacuation orders were lifted as crews worked to mop up hotspots, but officials warned that years of drought and disease have weakened many trees, and those dead and downed trees and logs continue to pose problems. The number of acres burnt in California this year is already eclipsing the number by this time last year, which also set a state record. By the end of 2020, roughly 4.1 million acres of land had been scorched in California. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, "Last year was quite an anomaly in August, when we had over 14,000 lightning strikes that caused multiple wildfires at one time. Hopefully that does not happen again this year," she added, "but what we are seeing this year is we didn't have as much rainfall, and that makes the fuels more susceptible to burning." The raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across western United States region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them even more difficult. More than 60% of the Western United States is suffering exceptional or extreme drought right now, the highest rating since the authorities began monitoring the phenomena 20 years ago. Temperatures have also reached historic levels, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, marking 585 all-time records in the past 30 days. Emphasizing that residents in the area must remain vigilant, Rand said, "When we have heat waves like this, we're always concerned." Writing in the Washington Post, meteorologist Matthew Cappucci said, "The next punishing heat wave is expected to start in the coming days and reach a critical peak by the next 10 days. It will be centered on a swath of the Rocky Mountains in the United States and up into Canada, bringing temperatures up to 30 degrees Fahrenheit above the average for this time of the year." Meteorologist Matthew Cappucci predicted, "In addition to the hot temperatures, the sultry air mass will spare additional wildfire growth and ignite across western United States, where dozens of wildfires are currently burning." Satellite imagery posted on Twitter by the National Weather Service showed 4 giant clouds forming over the Bootleg wildfire, with the southernmost starting to mass into the most extreme fire clouds of its sort, known as pyrocumulonimbus. Such clouds, which occur when heat rises from a wildfire, can cause hail, lightning, and tornadoes that can in themselves be extremely dangerous on the ground. The Weather Service said the cloud pattern was terrifying in its own right and asked the public to send positive thoughts and well wishes to the firefighters right now. It's a tough time for them. Fatigue has already started to set in for the first responders battling blazes as this is just the beginning of a fire season expected to get worse in the coming months. The University of California at Los Angeles Public Health Professor David Eisenman in a statement said, "We're talking about a new kind of fire season, with repeated and persistent fire producing weeks and months of smoke," noting that the compounding disasters will take a mental toll on residents as well. David Eisenman added, "Weeks at a time, most people are resilient, but if it happens for a few months every summer, there's a different story, and months of smoke are the new thing that we're going to see."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The importance of combating corruption in the judiciary branch and protecting the reputation of honorable judges. You should not say, "No, we know him. The report is not correct." You should not act like this. You must dispatch a vigilant investigation team. This is one of those conditions where you should take the reports seriously. I think it was in the previous term. I do not correctly remember if this happened at the time of Mr. Raisi or in the previous term, when they put together a team which would secretly visit courts of law in provincial cities and would keep things under surveillance. This is a very good course of action. You should mobilize and dispatch individuals to verify the matter and to see how much this claim is true or not. After all, Seeing with one's own eyes is very effective. On paper, many things cannot be understood. Unfortunately, these days I cannot have much contact with the people. But for many years, I always had a lot of contact with people. I witnessed things that are only understood in public meetings and in direct contacts, things that cannot be understood on paper and by reading reports and the like. The judiciary branch should be in close contact with people and with active groups in society. The next point is about presence among the people, a point that I just mentioned. One of Mr. Racy's strong points in the judiciary branch was presence among the people. You should not stop doing this. The honorable officials in the judiciary branch should not stop doing this after his departure. This is a very good and important course of action, and as I mentioned earlier, it will yield many blessings. Being among the people and being in contact with active groups in society, such as academic, seminary, and economic activists, and activists working on matters related to women and the ones working on tribal matters, being in contact with them is very important. It is very important that judiciary officials, especially the head of the judiciary, be in contact with the groups that work in these fields. There is so much in the field of production that one cannot understand until one has contacted and heard from the people who are active in the issues of production, such as officials in charge of labor issues and laborers themselves. Communication with these active groups is part of popular presence and public communication, and therefore we must pay attention to it. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.